Hey, everybody, and welcome back to the Teach Me to Code podcast. This is your host, Charles Max Wood, and this week we're going to be talking to Gregory Brown from Ruby Mendicant University. Greg is actually somebody that I've interacted with a few times. I read his book, Ruby Best Practices, and anyway, he was on the Ruby Rogues podcast the last couple of times. He's been in the Ruby community for quite a while. The interesting thing with this interview is not so much the Ruby, it's more the learning and the environment. So he has this Ruby Mendicant University is free. They accept people every few months. I think their next round is in July. And anyway, it's a really, really interesting way to get people together and have them help each other learn. So I highly recommend you go check out Ruby Mendicant University. Before we get started, I do need to mention our sponsor. We have NewRelic.com. New Relic is an application management tool. It's awesome. And it provides a lot of information that is really useful when you're trying to figure out what's wrong with your application or why it's going slow. So go check it out. They do Java, .NET, PHP, Ruby, pretty much anything you'd want to use on the web. So go check them out at NewRelic.com. You can also find a banner in the sidebar on teachmetocode.com where you can go and check out their stuff through that. And we actually get a little commission if you do that. So I really rather appreciate you doing that. Also, please go leave a review in iTunes. And with that, I'll go ahead and jump into the interview and we'll talk on the other end. Hey, everybody. This is Charles Max Wood with the Teach Me to Code podcast. And this week, I'm going to be talking to Gregory Brown. For those of you who don't know who Gregory is, he's actually contributed quite a bit to the Ruby community. He's been pretty involved lately with the Ruby Gems project, kind of straightening out some of the worries and things that people have had there. In fact, if you're interested, you can go check out rubyrogues.com. He filled us in quite a bit on that there. And so we might talk about it a bit here, but not a ton. He also wrote Ruby Best Practices, which is a pretty handy book. And he runs the Ruby Mendicant University, which I haven't participated in, but I've talked to a few people who have, and they're all very enthusiastic about it, which makes me very interested in what it is and what it's about. So welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Thanks.
So really quickly, I think I'm going to jump in on Ruby Mendicant first. What is Ruby Mendicant University and kind of how did it get started?
So what it is it's a free online school for software developers. And what we do is we combine training with mentoring. So it's really more than just teaching people just basic technical skills. It's also helping them improve in a lot of different ways. So in particular, we're aiming towards people who are intermediate developers. They may have some programming experience, but they might want to get a better job, or they might want to contribute to open source, or do some of the things that experienced developers can do. But that's the sort of stuff where you might not be able to find books or tutorials that will get you there. So we use the program to have them work through projects and then give them hands-on advice as they work through them and orient them both with the technical skills and the soft skills as they go through that stuff. I got involved in it because for the longest time I was trying to find a way to mentor people and teach people because you know, a great friend of mine, James Gray, taught me a whole lot over a period of years and really gave me what I needed so that I could have a career in software. And I found that one-on-one teaching while trying to maintain a job and all that stuff was hard for me to do. But doing some larger groups that are still small enough where I can personalize with people and just sort of making it my whole job, so to speak, seems to work. So that's sort of how it got started.
And that makes sense. It's really interesting to me for a couple of reasons. One is that, you know, most offerings out there really focus on the beginner. And they are focused on, you know, here are the basics and here's how you get going. And so, you know, where you aren't really focused on the beginner, you're focused on the intermediate or, you know, semi-advanced programmer, you know, that's kind of an interesting area to be in. Why did you choose that area as opposed to, you know, doing the beginner focused thing? I mean, wouldn't that have been easier, or was there another reason?
Well, it would be easier, but it wouldn't be nearly as interesting. And I also feel that a lot of that stuff is, beginners can be pretty well served by books. They might still need someone to help from time to time. You know, they, if they can get involved with the users group and have someone to talk to, that's useful. But the people who are really underserved are the people who either there are no books out there for them to read about the topics they're interested in, or the books alone won't get them there. So, I mean, a lot of this stuff becomes experience-based. And the kind of person that I want to work with is the one where if I spend an hour with them, it might completely change the way that they look at something because they just missed something. And, you know, to get from beginner to expert, there's this huge space in the middle that's underserved. So I just think that I'm probably making the most impact, especially because of the style of the way that we do things, making everything project-based and not having formal lectures, but just mentoring people and things like that. I think that's where it serves well. And also, them having a basic understanding of programming helps me because I can tell them, oh, go read this to catch up on this or that. And I don't, because I'm teaching online, I don't need to handhold them through every single step of the way, which helps a lot.
Okay, so the program sounds like it's a little more than just taking a class, or, you know, you said it's not lecture-based. So how does the program work exactly?
Well, it's something that we're constantly under review, but the one thing that's remained constant is the core skills course that we put people through. And that course has the students working on an open source project that they proposed at the time of the course starts of their own. And then on top of that, they work on four projects that I've selected for them. And those are normally, there's various different exercises. So they might be working with web services, they might be implementing parts of a game or something like that. But they're all things that are sort of realistic projects, things that at the end you have working code that actually does something useful. It's not guaranteed that it's going to be something that's of particular value to the rest of the world, but sometimes it is. There's exercises that have produced useful software that the students have released and people actually use. And the idea is we give them problems that are hard enough and interesting enough that the questions arise naturally. And then we have lots of mentors who have taken the course before that get involved and help out, and myself. And we do code reviews, and we discuss things over mailing list and IRC, and the course pretty much emerges on its own as a result of that. We keep our courses to 15 students or less, and I spend a couple days each week just doing whole days of office hours. So we get to really get to know our students on a one-on-one basis. I mean, it's a three-week course, but I spend several hours with each of the students individually. It's very effective. It was an experiment at first, but now we've done 9 of those, and they've worked really well.
That sounds really interesting. And, you know, it's something that I've looked at applying to myself. It just seems like whenever I get around to applying, and for those of you who aren't familiar, you go to puzzlenode.com and you try some of the puzzles, and then that's effectively your application. Did I miss anything on that?
Oh, yeah, that's right. I should have talked about the applications process. What we do is every time we have a new application open, we're releasing 4 problems to Puzzle Node. People need to solve at least 2 of them. Puzzle Node works like Project Euler, so the answers get validated immediately. They're right or wrong. And that's nice because people need to solve at least 2. And if they get them right, then we know that they've at least solved the problem. Then they send the code to us, and we review the code for quality.
That makes sense. And then you can pick the people who seem to fit the course the best.
Right. And what we do, we have a policy, at least for the last 2 times that we've done this, that 100% of the people who apply will get at least a code review in return for it. So the people who didn't make it, we tell them, why, and then we give them like an hour of time with one of our mentors to talk about what they could do to improve and get involved in some way. So it really, the question is whether or not they're a good fit right now, and we balance it out. You know, there's a lot of people who come in and they're definitely qualified and then they just get accepted immediately. There's other people who are more borderline, and as long as we don't have a course where everybody is at that level, then we can bring in a few people that we feel like might take some work, you know. And the real goal is just to balance out, to make sure that we're using our time efficiently and giving people the best amount of help. And so when we turn people away, the worst case is we're normally just saying it's not for you right now, but you can come later.
Uh-huh. That makes sense. Yeah, like I was saying, you know, it's I start looking at applying and then I realize just how little time I have to put into something like this. Yeah. But at the same time, I really feel like an investment into a skill set, especially a core skill set, with whatever programming language you're used to, be it Ruby or something else, I think it's worth the investment in time. You know, you just have to, you have to figure out your priorities and where, when and where that fits.
Yeah, it is. As of right now, it is a major time commitment, just because the applications process is non-trivial, and then it's 3 weeks of 20 hours or more of work on the part of the students.
Right.
And then a lot of our students do stay active. We do have alumni courses and things like that, and they help out with building out the infrastructure, which is actually surprisingly complicated, building out our course administration software and things like Puzzle Node and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. Maintaining RMU is a big commitment. Not that students have to do it, but a lot of them choose to.
Right.
So our alumni, some of them have had like full-time jobs and have somehow managed to make it work. Others have planned ahead and, you know, take a little bit of time off, like, you know, one day a week or something like that. And some of our students have more flexible. But it's really, it is a big time commitment, and we're trying to find ways to make that better. The course itself will continue to be that big commitment, but we want to do things like hour-long mentoring sessions here and there with people and stuff like that, or other smaller commitment things.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And, you know, I have a good friend here, Brandon Hayes, who has gone through Ruby Mendicant University, and he, you know, he was telling me how much he's enjoyed and gotten from, you know, gotten from the courses that he took and his participation after he kind of, I guess, passed the course. So it's been interesting to me to, you know, kind of get a feel for this and see where things have gone. I want to change tactics a little bit and talk just briefly about the Ruby Gems. I don't know what to call it, an uprising, I guess. You know, there's been a lot of discussion about it, where it's going, where it should go. And it seems like you kind of stepped in and I don't know if people were talking before to each other, but it seems like, you know, a lot of that has happened since then. What's your feeling now as far as the direction that things are going with Ruby Gems?
Ruby Gems has gotten a lot better over the last couple of weeks, both, you know, in the plans for the future and for just the right now. It was a couple of weeks ago to the point where you couldn't look anywhere where there was Ruby news without seeing a bunch of fighting about Ruby Gems.
Uh-huh.
And all of that has pretty much quieted down, which is good. But there's been a lot of practical changes made by the Ruby Gems team that have helped quiet things down. Those warnings that were bugging people are pretty much gone. The release cycle is slowing down and being treated better. People will know when things will break, at the very least now. And the breakage should go down. The last big problem was that RubyGems 1.8 was still breaking Rails 2.3. The latest release of Rails 2.3 fixed that. And a release of RubyGems that, if it's not out now, will be out very soon, will retroactively fix it, so that even if you don't upgrade your Rails, it would fix the problem if you upgrade RubyGems. I've been begging people to send me reports of things that are broken, and we pretty much worked through all of them. that problem of libraries people really want to use not working with RubyGems 1.8 has been solved. And from there moving forward, we're just working on improving the communications, and there should be within the next week or so an actual RubyGems blog so that you can find the information in a centralized place. It'll be a little bit more formal in the sense that it won't be like someone's personal blog. So the information there will be probably without the personal conflicts and all of that.
Right.
And the team themselves have really stepped up, and I mean, I've been sitting on the IRC and watching the bug trackers and things like that, and things have been civil. People are working together. I don't entirely know if we've solved everyone's problems yet, but at the very least, people aren't yelling at each other or fighting or anything like that, and it's getting better. It's just getting better.
Sounds good. You know, it's interesting. I mean, it seems like this year has had a couple of high-profile debates, you know, where, you know, David Heinemeier Hansen said something about RSpec and Cucumber, and people went kind of crazy for a little bit, and then they changed the defaults on Rails, and so the people using Rails who didn't like those defaults, you know, again, there was a bit of contention and controversy over that, and then the RubyGems stuff came up, and, you know, it's interesting to me both that, you know, people get so passionate about it and care. And, you know, and I think there's a lot to be said for that in our community. And also at the same time, you know, that they all seem to resolve themselves pretty quickly. I mean, everybody just kind of put their opinion out there. And then, you know, after a few minutes or after a few days, maybe a week or two, you know, most of the conflict had died down. And, you know, only the handful of really vocal people were left, you know, kind of saying, no, we're right. We're really right. And everybody else, you know, more or less just moved along because it, you know, ultimately it doesn't really make a huge difference which testing framework you use as long as your tests make sense. And, you know, the defaults in Rails, well, most of those you can just pull them out of your gem file, you know, and things like this, you know. I think this was a little bit different debate, but at the same time, you know, you see a lot of people, you know, seeing the work that you're doing and that, you know, Evan and Eric and Ryan are doing on RubyGems, and, you know, kind of getting a feel for, okay, you know, things are going to be taken care of in the right way. And, you know, I haven't heard a whole lot about it lately, you know, other than people just keeping track of what's going on at this point.
Right. At this point, I mean, I don't even know, like I was actively in a mediation role or whatever you want to call it. I mean, people claimed I wasn't being a particularly non-biased mediator, but whatever. I was still actively working with people who were really pissed off about this. And there was a lot of tensions were really high. There was a lot of urgency. But like when you look at the real problems, there were only a handful of problems that were truly urgent, and those got dealt with quickly. And yep. Once those were dealt with, things really started to quiet down. And I don't know. I mean, I think that this is just an internet phenomena of people getting really into drama for a couple of days, and then their attention spans are short, and they once the immediate problem has been solved, they move to something else.
Yeah.
I don't want to downplay. There are serious issues with RubyGems even still that need to be dealt with. These are things that can be dealt with in the time frame of months or years, and not minutes. You know,
right.
And at the very least, the structural problem of feeling like there's a disconnect between the community and the maintainers on that project has been somewhat solved. And I think that'll make a big difference moving forward. Those discussions can still happen, but in a more productive manner.
Yeah, absolutely. And this kind of leads into something else that is related. I've been wanting to watch your video that you made in response to Brandon talking about how hard it is to get involved in open source. You built the Prawn library. I think you did that after becoming the maintainer of the PDF Writer library. Is that right?
That's
right.
Yep.
And, you know, so it's you're not just coming at this from, you know, an interested party in the community, but you've actually built open source software, you know, stuff that people actually use, you know, on a day-to-day basis, you know, to do their work. So I'm a little curious, you know, what all is involved in open source? You know, what considerations do you have to have that maybe you don't when you're working on a commercial product or your own website?
That's a big question. But let me think. In particular, when you think about open source that grows very popular, Ruby Gems is extraordinarily popular because it's used by everybody who uses Ruby. Prawn and previously PDF Writer, those are more popular than you might think. I mean, they're not like at the scale of Rails, but there's probably not much between Rails and, you know, your everyday other Ruby libraries that would be more popular than that. Like, I think Prawn's been downloaded 100,000 times or more, or something like that. We've got over 1,000 followers on GitHub and all of that stuff. So it's a big project. And what I learned the hard way from working on a big project like that is that pretty much any change that you can make will anger someone. and that there's the thing that's technically right to do with the project, and then there's the social aspect of things and also the communication aspect of things.
Right.
And what I learned most strongly and directly through trial by error, basically, is that as an open source project gets large and its user base gets large, that the ability to be a good programmer and the ability to be a good community leader are orthogonal skill sets. You don't automatically become one or the other. Mm-hmm. And sure, like, you would expect that you could learn that as you go, and you can, but the project will very likely grow faster than your project management skills grow.
Right.
And that's the case for most large popular open source projects. I feel like there's a lot of people who are de facto community leaders that never necessarily wanted to be. And that makes it so that they often get out of tune with their users. And then it takes sort of a second revolution of people getting involved in the project that care about the community aspect to keep the project healthy in its ongoing success. And that happened with Prawn in the sense that when it was just me working on it, it was me against the users.
Right.
As we had grew to a core team of 5 people, we got to the point where we realized that me fighting the user wasn't good for the project, neither technically nor for the community. And they gradually helped out with those sort of things, improved documentation, took some of the questions that were difficult for me to answer without getting emotional about it, and that really helped. And that's the sort of thing that I want to see happen with Ruby Gems, because it really can help make a big difference. But I guess just getting back to your original question, as either a consumer of open source or someone looking to get involved in it, it's important to recognize that the work of a maintainer is actually a very difficult job. And that there's a big difference between putting some code out there and saying, okay, I'm putting out there, if it's useful, great, and then basically not maintaining it moving forward, and agreeing to maintain something that a lot of people use.
Right.
And the fantasy that, like, working on a popular open source project is going to open a lot of doors for you without some extra responsibility is really bad. Because a lot of people get excited about the upsides and forget about the difficulties or don't know about them. And so I've learned through teaching at RMU that being a user or just a developer trying to get along is a hard thing. But at first I learned through working on Prawn and some other open source stuff that I've done that being a maintainer is really hard. And I don't think that's adequately represented. I don't think that people realize that as much as they should.
Yeah, well, I can definitely see that. At the same time, I think a lot of us who simply consume open source but don't necessarily build open source, you know, it's really hard to see that. It's really hard to, you know, be confronted by that because, you know, ultimately I pull something down off of Ruby Gems or even use Ruby Gems, and I am fairly well accustomed over the last few years to it just working, you know. It works in a certain way. It does certain things. And so I guess I just expect it to work. And, you know, I think society has become a little more litigious, a little more argumentative. And, you know, so we do tend to be a little more confrontational than we need to be. But at the same time, it's interesting that, we just expect it to work. And so when it doesn't, we're not only surprised, but we're a little bit, angry or disappointed. And, you know, unfortunately, people don't recognize that, that there's a time commitment and a sacrifice that that people are making to put it out there.
Yeah, it's so that's a difficult problem, because being frustrated that something that has worked for you stopped working is a valid thing to feel. It's just that the way that you act on those feelings can be either helpful or harmful to a project. And a lot of times it's harmful because people don't understand the whole structure of the way things work. To speak to the point, because I think that was exactly what happened with Ruby Gems that really frustrated people. Something that pretty much just worked for them started having problems.
Well, one other problem that I can see is that a lot of other things, even require, when you use Ruby Gems is different. So everything more or less works through certain parts of Ruby Gems. So it wasn't just that Ruby Gems didn't work as expected, but it kind of affected a lot of things that weren't Ruby Gems, itself.
Exactly, because Ruby Gems is upstream of pretty much everything, including Rails. So every change that happens to Ruby Gems affects everybody, mm-hmm. effectively, and it affects everything. If Ruby Gems is broken, your entire process is broken in a lot of ways. So that's something that's a really important thing for maintainers to realize and have respect for. And I don't know that they didn't have that feeling before, but I don't think they did a good job of communicating it. So it's very easy to feel like people are really playing around with something that should be really stable. But on the other hand, coming from a maintenance perspective, some of the changes that need to be made are bug fixes or cleanups or refactorings. The reason why they become so urgent is you get to the point where you go and you try and fix one bug, and in the process of fixing it, you introduce three new bugs. Mm-hmm. Or you try to add one simple feature that thousands of users have been begging for, and in the process, you realize you can't do that without rewriting a large portion of project. Anybody who's ever done a rescue project in which they went in and took over an abandoned Rails project and tried to bring it back up to speed would have sympathy with that sort of situation.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Now, a lot of software grows organically rather than being designed properly, and uh-huh. Ruby Gems is certainly one of those situations. In a lot of ways, when I don't know what happened with PDF Writer to get it to the point where it was unmaintainable and I had to write Prawn, but Prawn itself, it reached a point where it was like, we have to change the whole structure for it to meaningfully be improved from this point forward. And we can't maintain the backwards compatibility because the whole idea is wrong. And building the compatibility layer would be maintaining basically an entire parallel system sitting on top of the new one.
Uh-huh.
Ruby Gems is sitting in that area. And I think that solving this problem could have been done in a better way, mm-hmm. Without such a strong impact on users. But I also think that some of the changes just needed to happen, and that wasn't meaningfully conveyed enough to the users.
Right.
Things might break in the short term. We have a path to fix it. This won't be how it is all the time. And mm-hmm. that's the case. That's how they feel about stuff. And they're at the point now where I think that the API should be reasonably stable. Breakage should stop. Mm-hmm. But there was a period of 6 months or so where things were breaking without much explanation at all, except for we're cleaning stuff up. And that really kills people with these. It's like, oh, we don't really care about the code cleanliness. We just want this to work. But what they're really saying is we're cleaning stuff up because there's, this important bug to fix and this important bug to fix. And we can't do it unless we did that. And if someone actually said that, I think people would be a lot less pissed off than they are now.
Right. Well, one other thing that I think is interesting is that, you talked about organically grown code versus the situation that you have where somebody sits down and designs things out. And even then, I mean, you know, when you're designing something, you're making assumptions. And if your assumptions are incorrect, and then you move into a place where, you know, you realize that these assumptions are incorrect, you still may wind up rewriting well-defined, well-planned, well-designed, well-written code simply because your assumptions were incorrect when you wrote it.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, that's another thing when we're talking about, like, what's the thing that is different about open source versus just doing commercial work or something like that. Well, you're going to have changing requirements no matter what.
Yeah.
But the thing is that when you do open source, your customer, so to speak, is a bunch of people that you have never met and can't anticipate the way that they're going to use your software.
Uh-huh.
And the vast majority of them don't even communicate with you at all. And then you find that your software is being used in ways that you not only made incorrect assumptions about, but that you could have never anticipated because it's a completely different use case.
Right.
And so there's a whole lot of that in open source in general, and that makes things really hard, which means that like the best way to handle that in open source is either to be really, really clear about what the intended uses are and have a very limited basic API to do those things, or to build systems that are designed to be flexible and easy to change. Neither of those things are easy to do. And it's a skill set that you need to develop, again, that's on top of the basic level of solving a particular problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, I'm still learning in my own on that sort of stuff, but I've definitely seen what doesn't work in a lot of different ways.
Yeah, well, it's interesting that... It seems like the people problems and the code problems, you know, kind of, at least with some of these open source projects, kind of go hand in hand, and just how drastically one can affect the other. I want to move on and talk about something else, though, really quickly. I'm interested in, you wrote the Ruby Best Practices book,
mm-hmm.
and that was, what, a couple of years ago? Years ago?
2009.
So I was wondering, you know, what prompted you to write the book? And I'm also curious, you know, would you recommend that somebody else write a book like that? Or if you had to do it over again to convey the same information, would you do it the same way or a different way?
So the reason why I wrote the book is because I just had sort of the idea pop into my head and reasonably fully formed. And I tried to put it to the side and it just kept popping up. And so I decided I wanted to write on it. And again, it was actually just like RMU was focusing on the intermediate developer. The book was designed for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I think that where I work best with people is grabbing the people who have just gotten far enough where they've done what they can do on their own and then need to be exposed to new ideas to get pulled out of that. So, the way that I wrote the book is I used a bunch of open source examples, both from my own code and from other people's code. I simplified things where necessary to make it easy to understand. But for the most part, I kept full intact code examples together. And then I talked through the decision-making process and why a problem was solved in a particular way and that sort of stuff. And that was my best way of emulating what I would do if I was working with someone face-to-face, because I think that you can learn a lot in that sort of environment. And that's why I think the book is interesting. There's not I don't know that 100% of it is still relevant. I think that some of the trends have changed and things like that, but a good portion of it is still valuable because it's more about how you think about code and how you work through things and reason about things than it is about using a particular technique. And so, I mean, the only thing that I would do if I went back to it is I would come back to it the 2011 mindset and not the 2008 mindset that I started it
with. Right.
It's an open source book, so people could actually update it, but I would actually recommend just starting over because I didn't try to be comprehensive. I picked a few topics I thought were really important and then just worked through those, and that formula could work for other things as well.
Yeah, that was one thing that I noticed too when I read it, was that you know, it covered a bunch of different topics, you know, to varying depths, and yeah, it wasn't an overall, you know, this is how you should be writing all of your Ruby code for all of everything, you know. It focused on, you know, what, like 8 or 9 specific things, and specific areas and how you would approach them. And it was helpful that it went into some of the, you know, the thinking about the problem as opposed to just well, obviously you would use this library and you would do it this way.
Right. Well, I mean, I just think that, I mean, honestly, I'm so disappointed with the way that we tend to do education, because so much is about the collection and presentation of information rather than teaching people how to think and reason about things. I mean, their reference materials are great. Basic tutorials to get people started are great. But for the most part, I just really think that the way that we do broadcast material like books or screencasts or whatever, they should be designed on exposing the techniques so that people can apply them themselves.
Right.
And that's why it was so important to me to try it. If you look at those 8 or 9 chapters, what you see is a pattern for analyzing code, which is going to be more valuable than any of the particular tricks that I go through. But in order to get that out of the book, you have to spend a lot of time with it, and you actually have to try and apply the concepts and that sort of thing. I think that we should have more workbooks and less references, actually.
I think that's fair enough. I mean, you know, I have a bachelor's degree in computer engineering. So, I mean, most of my classes were actually focused on hardware rather than software, but I had to take my fair share of software courses. And a lot of those cases, I mean, you know, they would kind of give you some kind of framework to work in, but most of the examples were contrived at best. Mm-hmm. And, you know, really, you'd go to the lecture, you'd sit through the lecture for an hour, they talk about some theory about this or that or the other, and then, you know, say, go do the lab. And so you'd go do the lab, and you'd suffer through, you know, whatever it was that they hadn't told you. And by far, that was the most educational part of it, was sitting down and writing the code. And so I always wondered, well, what if they gave you real-world examples, you know, to work with real-world code, and, you know, we just skip the lectures? You know, how would that compare? Or, you know, at the very best, you know, you sit down and it walks you through a concept and then immediately forces you to go and confront it.
Right. Well, that's the thing that I think that we've stumbled on, that and it worked with my book and it works with RMU. What I like to do is just flip things. So it's like you're working on a problem, you're thinking through a problem, and then if there's a reference or if there's a tutorial out there that could help you with that, then when you encounter the need for it, then that's when you take the student and you point them at something that they can read for that. So, like, I think that it's – I'm not trying to say, like, it's not an anti-intellectual statement where I'm saying people shouldn't study.
Right.
Stuff, but that that as much as possible, that you should have a goal or need in mind so that when you go and read, you read with a lot more purpose and motivation, because you're trying to solve a particular problem. And then, you know, if you want to explore out on the boundaries of that, just by taking in some knowledge about it, that's fine. But at least you have like a hook to get you started there.
Right. Well, and it's true too that, you know, when I'm going out and reading the material because I need to solve a problem or I need to, you know, approach code in a certain way, I learn way more under those circumstances than when I'm merely curious and go and, you know, learn about this technology or that technology and then never do anything with it.
Right. I mean, I don't know that there's, I mean, a lot of times the thing is learning about this technology or that, reading a bunch of blogs, reading a bunch of books, it's a feel-good experience because you feel like you're getting something done when you do it.
Right.
You feel like you're expanding your knowledge, and in a way you are. But I tend to limit that to being a leisure activity or like some time that I set aside. So once in a while, I'll set aside something and I say, I really want to just dig in and learn this topic. But I think that there's this notion that that's actually how you build your experience, your practical experience base. And I got to say, that's not the case. Like, I don't think that if I read 20 books a year, that it would make me a better programmer.
Right.
Even in the first, I almost regret, because that's how I used to try to learn. I almost regret doing that because a lot of it really was wasted time where I learned something, but it wasn't something that I really needed.
Right.
So I think that there's a place for that, but that it could be emphasized less, and hands-on experience could be emphasized more. And then mentorship is really important, because what I want to do is I want to read everything that would help me, but right. I want to have someone who's been through what I've been through before tell me what I should be reading, so that I don't just read everything in the hopes that it will eventually be useful someday.
Yeah, I agree. I think that there is something to be said for reading the books and the blogs, but ultimately what my experience tells me is that if there are general concepts that I need to understand, then I can get those out of books and blogs. Certain principles in programming and things like that. If I'm exposed to it a few times via reading, then I can begin to internalize it. And then when I start writing my code, then I'll be thinking about it and go through an exercise on it. Does that make sense? But, it's not until I apply it to my code does it actually manifest in any meaningful way.
Right. Yeah. So it's kind of like understanding concepts in physics versus actually doing physics. It's like,
right.
You can talk to someone in a half hour and explain any basic physical concept to them, but then them sitting down and doing the math is a totally different thing. And I think that applies a lot to programming as well. Yeah. I think the thing is that we are so heavily networked, and we have so many resources in terms of users groups or online mailing lists or whatever. And I think that we don't use those well enough. I mean, it's easy enough to say, oh, I'm looking to solve this program. Does anyone know what resources I should be looking for to help me with this problem? And then I think that we can harness that a whole lot more than, I don't know, when I was first getting involved in programming, it wasn't quite as easy to get that access to that sort of information. But now that we have it, I just think that we can make our learning a lot more purposeful, which will in turn mean that we get a lot more out of it, and then keep the general curiosity as a leisure activity, because it's useful. It's just not going to be useful in a way that necessarily, I mean, the worst thing that I see is someone who says, I'm trying really hard to learn programming, and I've read these 9 books, and I haven't gotten it anywhere. And then you ask, well, what do you want to learn programming for? And they say, oh, well, I don't know, I just wanted to be really good at programming because I heard it was a good thing to do. And it's like, well, what problem are you trying to solve? And they can't even come up with a simple idea of what they might want to use programming for. And they get frustrated because they spend a year studying and not even a day practicing.
Yeah, the other thing that there is to that is that I see people who get involved because they hear that it's a good living, or you get paid well for it, or this or that, and then they get in pretty deep, and then they start doing it and they find out that they don't like it. And
right.
I feel sorry for those people too, because they just what was the point? Because I think life's about more than just making money, and if it's something that you enjoy, or then it's something that you'll try and excel at, and if it's not, then you won't. But.
Yeah, and part of it though is I don't know that people can find a way to like it until they know what's possible.
Right.
And unfortunately, if they dig headfirst into a bunch of abstract books and theory and all that stuff, they won't. I mean, I think the best way to get someone to like programming is to sit down and say, oh, what are you interested in? Look, you can actually build that, and here's how you can build that.
Uh-huh.
But then there are certain people who just won't like it. I mean, this is not you do have to like this career to do it, because it's a lifetime learning experience. You can't just learn the skills and then just use them. You have to stay up with it, and I mean, you have to actually love this. There's got to be easier jobs out there that pay well than this, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, I do want to come back around to your idea that, people who have a project, do well with programming. And really with that, the thing that I've seen more than anything else is that for most people, it's not the ability to express whatever their idea is in code. It's it's the thought process. It's the challenge. It's the, solving the problem, The characters on the screen aren't what's important. It's actually that expression and that feeling of accomplishment and the, I don't know, the challenge of approaching something that's hard and coming out victorious. I don't know exactly how to quantify it, but you know, a lot of that is at least for me what makes programming fun.
Well, I think a lot of people, they look at a problem that they want to solve, but they see it as this one sort of amorphous blob that is just this one big thing, and they can't easily find a way to figure out where they should get started with it, and they can't easily find a way to break it down so that they can work on something from end to end and in success. Yeah. Like, I try to make a point so that every time I sit down to work on something, whether it's for a day or for an hour, that I end up with some meaningful progress, something I can actually use at the end of it.
Uh-huh.
And to some people who spend literally months trying to work on their idea but then yet get nothing working, I mean, that is a horrible experience. I don't know why. You would have to have some extreme dedication to be able to keep trying something at the end of that. And I think that's partly to do with the way that we teach things and the lack of available mentorship for people who are just getting started with this stuff. We need to lead beginner programmers to success earlier and also teach them about the skills of problem solving, because being able to understand code and read what it does and say, oh, it does this and that and this and that, is a very different skill from being able to say, okay, well, this is how you approach the problem, this is how you break the problem down, and this is how you actually solve it.
Right.
So there's so many people working on things and thinking about them in ways that are way more complicated than they have to be, because there isn't an especially good resource for teaching you how to solve problems solidly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's where a math background for me has helped me. I don't use the math in practice, but the problem-solving aspect of things I use quite a bit.
Yeah.
But not everybody's going to have that, and I think that we can do a better job somehow of giving them a way to do that.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to change tactics a little bit and talk a little bit more about open source. How should people go about getting involved with open source? I mean, I think a lot of people get the idea that to get involved in open source, they have to go write some big project that everyone will use. But it seems like there are a lot of ways to get involved with existing projects. Have you had much experience with that? And what recommendations do you have for people who want to get involved?
Honestly, I mean, I, against the better recommendations, even when I started this 10 years ago, I started my own projects because I was so intimidated by the process of getting involved in existing projects. Granted, that was a while ago and things were a lot different then. I think things have gotten better now. But the thing that worries me is that, again, the thing that I learned over the last year or two is that open source maintainers are not necessarily good community leaders. They're not necessarily good educators. You can definitely find projects that do emphasize that. And it's very easy to see just by lurking for a little while, checking how they interact in the bug trackers, how they interact on a mailing list, how they interact over IRC, whatever. You could post the question to the mailing list saying, hey, I'm a beginner, I want to help. I don't really have experience with open source. Would you mind helping me out a little bit or telling me on those resources? I think that beginners should shop around as much as possible so that they find a combination of A, a project that they like working on, and B, a community that will support them as they work on those things. But there are ways that you can work on things even in absence of that, because if you can find an experienced developer either online or through a local users group, and you can have them sort of prepare you to make a patch and contribute to an open source project, that can help too. You know, someone who has contributed to open source before, it doesn't even necessarily need to be on your project. They can tell you some of the things that you're likely to get caught up on and help you through the process. And that's really like, we're adding, this has always been an option, but we're sort of formalizing it in RMU, is we allow the students to for one of their projects, work on our open source software, the stuff that runs RMU. But starting in July, we're opening that up, that project up to working on other projects as well. And we're going to reach out to a group of people that we think would be good fits for that on different open source projects. And we're also going to open it up so that people can contact us requesting that. We're going to pair our students with people on those projects so that they can contribute to those projects. And if that model works within RMU, maybe we can expand it outwards so that there could be a program like that that's open to the general community. Mm-hmm. But people out there who have some experience with this, they should really consider trying to help people with that too. Like if you're experienced, encourage beginners to help you with either your open source project or help them contribute to another thing, because doing it on your own is really hard. If you're doing it on your own, do your homework, shop around, look to see if it's going to be an inviting environment. Ask the question of, I'm a beginner, I want to help, but I may need some help myself. And don't be afraid to ask that. And if someone responds negatively to that, then that's not a project you should be working on anyway. There are lots of projects out there that will be happy to work with you, but there's plenty that are, I wouldn't say that they don't want to, but that's not their focus.
Right. That makes sense.
It's because community management and education are not only separate skills, they're extra work. If you've got a guy that's working on a project a few hours here and there in a spare time, has a family, has a full-time job, you might not have the time to help a beginner make their first patch to open source. And unfortunately, what happens is people come up and they want to help, and then they feel like they're putting a lot of effort into helping, and they are, and then they don't get appreciated for it because it's just a bad match. Mm-hmm. And so doing a little bit of investigation up front will help prevent first-time contributors from being disappointed with their results. And I think, you know, you mentioned Brandon. Brandon had that experience. He had the experience of people just basically ignoring him on projects, which to write his post about open source. But then he found Wayne Seguin on RVM, and Wayne really worked with him. I think he ended up just doing some documentation patches or something like that, but Wayne is the kind of guy that's around all the time and wants to help people. And there are people out there. We're like that. We're going to put something out there for our open source projects in RMU that basically says, if you're a beginner and you haven't done any open source at all before, you can still feel free to contact us and we'll find a way to make you helpful. Yeah. And we'll teach you the things that you need to know. We're lucky because that's sort of where we're focusing. But.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense. And you know, I think, you know, at least from the people that I've talked to a few people who have been involved in RMU, and they all really appreciate the effort and what they've gotten out of it. I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up just because, you know, I'm running out of time and I don't want to take too much of yours, but I really appreciate you coming onto the podcast and talking about this stuff. I think it's important. I think there are a lot of things that we talked about that people should be thinking about, and, you know, hopefully people can find a way to get involved. I mean, even if it's just getting involved in learning about how to code, you know, and getting involved in something like RMU, all the way up to, you know, building some open source project or contributing to an open source project that needs them and needs their expertise. So thanks again for coming on, and you know, hopefully we can do this again.
Yeah, that was great. Thanks.
Thank you. All right, we're back. I want to thank Greg again for coming on to the podcast. It's always so great to talk to people who are involved in the community in this way, and I really, really appreciate it. Before we get going too far, I want to thank New Relic for sponsoring the podcast, and I also want to bring up a couple of things that I've got going on. The first one is that I will be doing a Ruby on Rails summer camp, and it starts July 26th and goes through September 20th or something like that. It's an 8-week-long course, and I'm really trying to get together some great video content for that. I've written most of the curriculum already, so I just need to plug it into the learning management system. Anyway, so you'll have written content, you'll have about 2 hours of video every week, you'll have direct access to me through chat and through IM and email, and I'm also going to have a weekly webinar for the course, where you can hop on, ask questions about things that you're facing with Ruby or Ruby on Rails, and I'll try and answer those. So if you're interested in learning Ruby on Rails, go to teachmetocodeacademy.com, click on Ruby or Rails Summer Camp, and sign up for the course. Also, we have on railscoach.com, we have the Rails Coach's first stream, and that is a video membership site. It's $9 a month, and for $9 a month, you're probably going to get about 2 hours of video per month. And basically, I'm planning on covering basic Ruby on Rails topics. I figure I have 4 weeks per month, so I'm going to do something different each week of the month. So the first one is going to be Ruby on Rails. The next week is going to be just Ruby tips and tricks. The next week, I'm going to do a deep dive where I open up the Ruby on Rails code and dig into how a particular feature of Ruby on Rails works. So it should be an interesting exercise for both Rails developers and just general Ruby developers. And finally, the last week, I'm just going to jump into some technology that I've been playing with or checking out. You know, something new or different that is part of the Ruby or Rails or web ecosystem, you know, that's interesting. So, for example, I've been playing a lot with Cassandra, so that's what I'm going to be jumping in probably this next month. So I'll start putting videos out in July, and I really hope that you'll come on board. Do that to support this podcast and some of the other things that I've got going on. And overall, this is a great way to show your support. You can also leave feedback for the podcast by emailing chuck@teachmedeco.com, or you can call me at 801-367-6164 if you need help or if you want an application built. And with that, I'll wrap it up. Thanks for listening, and remember that writing the code is the easy part.